This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of local, national, and international concern. Our topic today? Cervical cancer. What is it? What's new in detection and treatment? My guest? Dr. Enrique Hernandez, the Abraham Roth Professor and Chairman of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Temple University School of Medicine. Thank you for coming on University Forum again, Dr. Hernandez.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a long time, and I gather that there's been some exciting new research going on in the field of detection and diagnostic tools. Let's start at the beginning. What is cervical cancer?
Well, if you look at the anatomy of women, the cervix is the tip of the uterus, also known as the womb. It's found in the vagina, and it's the entry to the uterus. The important thing about the cervix and cervical cancer is that it is the second most common cause of cancer death in women in the world. Fortunately, in the United States, that's not the case. The numbers of cervical cancer have progressively decreased since the 1960s. And today in the United States, cervical cancer makes up, it's number 12 on the list in terms of cancers in women. On the other hand, in an area like North Philadelphia, where Temple University Hospital is, we see as many women with cervical cancer as we see with other types of gynecologic malignancies. Well, in the country, the most common is endometrial, or cancer of the uterus, and cervical cancer should be only one-fifth of that. In North Philly, the population we serve, it is about the same.
Why is that? What makes for the difference?
The belief is access to health care. The health care is there. The women are not taking advantage and accessing the health care. Either they're not getting routine pap smears and physical examination, or when that's being done, whenever they come for health care, the pap smear is not being done. But we know that if a woman avail herself of routine pap smears, that the risk of cervical cancer decreases significantly.
Is that to say, then, that the detection of it would make a difference, that there's not necessarily a difference because of this population? What causes the cervical cancer?
Well, in the last decade, it's become clear that for a woman to develop cervical cancer, they need to be sexually active, and they need to acquire an infection with a virus that is known as a human papilloma virus, or HPV. That virus is very common in sexually active women and men. In some women, for some reason, that virus causes abnormalities of the cells that eventually will become cancers. That's an area of current research, looking to see if there is a genetic predisposition, if there's some reason why some women are increased risk compared to others. Because again, HPV, it's very common, but cervical cancer in the United States is not.
Well, when you say women sexually active, at some stage, most women are sexually active, whether it has nothing to do in terms of whether they're sexually active because they're married or not married, that kind of thing. We're not talking about promiscuity.
No, actually, if you look at the virus, and some people, something to be clear so that people are not afraid of saying I'm infected with HPV, is that it is believed that 85% of the adult population in the United States would have been exposed at some point in their life to HPV.
That's so important to know, because otherwise it sounds as though it's something they've done that's wrong or bad or against their own good health.
No, it's so common. Now, the question yet to be resolved is why cancer occurs in some women and not in others. On the other hand, it is known that to develop cervical cancer, you need to have been exposed to the virus, to the point that right now there's more and more work being done towards developing a vaccine. And there's some successes already, and now soon we'll be in the marketing phase and actually bringing to market some vaccines again against HPV.
Now, you mentioned the male and that men can have the virus. How does that work, and does he give it then to the woman, or What happens there?
The man will have the virus and will give it to the woman, and vice versa, the woman will give it to the male. The difference is that in the cervix has what we call a transformation zone. There's an area where some cells that are not as strong, let's say, or resistant to infection are being transformed to a different type of cell. That process where the cells are very active allows for the virus to incorporate itself into the cells and leaves the genetic information that the virus carries can incorporate itself into the cells and cause that cell to become neoplastic, meaning tumor-like, mm-hmm. and become cancerous. In men, you don't have that transformation zone. So men are not as high risk of developing penile cancer as women are of developing cervical cancer.
They develop penile cancer?
They do, but it's extremely rare, extremely rare. Now, one interesting piece of information is that men who are widowed and their spouse die of cervical cancer, they remarried, their new wife is at increased risk of cervical cancer because they're going to be transmitting that virus that they had.
But the virus, the thing that, it's the virus that has the HPV. That's one part of it. The other piece, though, is the transmission of cancer through that modality?
No, it's the virus has some genetic information that could damage some of the normal defense mechanism of the cells against cancer. So when your normal cells are damaged by the virus, cancer could develop. And that doesn't happen on every woman or man that has a virus. And that's a piece that is yet to be understood clearly, why some women are at risk and others are not. So the virus itself is not cancerous, but the changes that the genetic information that virus carries can block some of the normal function of the normal cells, causing them to become cancerous.
That's very interesting. It suggests then certainly the need for examination, particularly for cervical cancer. And as you say, in the United States, we're not seeing that quantitative amount compared to some other countries. Now, does that mean in many other countries they are not having that kind of health care that allows for both exploration and identification of the development of cancer in women? They're not getting regular pap smears or other kinds of tests?
They're not, for two reasons. One, the public health is not available to them. Another is cultural, in which the women do not want to have that type of examination. I think I mentioned to you a few years ago that I was invited to Guatemala one time to give a talk, and they told me, talk about whatever you want. So I thought I'd talk about the most common things we see, like endometrial cancer or even ovarian cancer. And I did, and they were very polite and very nice, and they listened, and they asked questions, and they thanked me. Then later they gave me information about their country and statistics, and I learned that they only have a couple of endometrial cancer cases a year. The same thing with ovarian, they haven't heard of that. Women don't get to be old enough to get those cancers, which occur in women who are in their 60s. They die of cervical cancer at an earlier age. And cervical cancer in developing countries is the number one cause of cancer death in women.
Now, in the area in which you practice within the zone of the North Philadelphia area that you mentioned, you see a little difference in the rate of cervical cancer than in other parts of the population?
Yes, it's much higher. And I think it's because we have a large population of Hispanics, African-American patients, Asians, and some of those patients are newly arrived to the United States, may not have health care coverage, so may not seek health care for preventive measures, but only for acute illnesses. And when they seek care, they may not undergo a complete exam on a pap smear.
What should happen to enhance that openness of health care in that area? I imagine a lot of people don't have the insurances. How do they get that kind of service to find out, to get those tests? That's the diagnostic testing.
It's education because, for example, if you look at Temple University Hospital, we have a clinic where those services are provided at no cost, at least the screening services. Also, the state of Pennsylvania have a program that is matched by the federal government that if a patient is diagnosed with a precancer lesion of the cervix, that for diagnosis and treatment, they will receive coverage through that program.
Is that right? So yeah. That if they were to come in from the area and first to get the testing, can they get pap smears and all of that without cost if they don't have any
insurance?
That
is correct. Both at Temple and Planned Parenthood and some other clinics in the city, they could receive at least a screening test and preventive care at little or no cost.
That's very important to know. Now, the screenings, I gather there are some new methods being developed as to being able to find out whether or not somebody is prone to cervical cancer. What's going on in new detections?
Well, the newest thing is the testing for HPV directly, just looking to see if the woman has HPV. Again, if the only way to get cervical cancer is by being infected with HPV, you can test and see if it's present or not.
Would you tell me what HPV actually stands for?
It's for human papilloma virus. I mentioned earlier the prevalence of human papilloma virus infection is very high, and it's higher in the younger women group. Therefore, this testing for HPV, it's only recommended for women over the age of 30, so older than 30. If you do it in teenagers and women in their 20s, almost all of them are going to test positive, and it wouldn't be helpful. But on the other hand, as a woman gets older, most women will be able to clear the infection by their own immune system. So by the time they get to be in their 30s, the HPV testing should be negative. If it is positive, that is a patient that is at risk of developing cervical cancer.
So as they get older, the immune system kicks in to help.
Well, the immune system have been working. It just it takes a little bit of time for it to complete its task. So in a very young patient, it doesn't happen yet. But as the woman gets older, it does what it's supposed to do.
Because the logical thinking might be that it would become more of a problem as one got older, but this is not so.
That is correct. The prevalence of HPV in the older women, it's lower than in the younger patients. There are also differences in terms of sexual behavior. I mean, as a woman gets older, the number of partners or sexual encounters may diminish. And therefore, reinfection is not a problem. So the younger woman may have multiple partners, and that increases the risk of infection and reinfection. So even if she gets exposed to the virus once and clears the virus, then she may get re-exposed to the virus again by a different partner.
In order to detect this, there, as you say, there have been some new kinds of modalities developing, one of which I gather is something called bioprobe.
The bioprobe is something we're working on, and it's still research. We're still gathering information about it, but it's something that we're very excited about. It's a probe that sends a very low-voltage electrical signal. The probe is narrower than a tampon, but a little bit longer. So they can be introduced in the vagina by the patient herself, at home if she wants. And what's outside, what stays outside, has a computer microchip. It sends a very low-voltage signal, and it measures the resistance of the tissue to that electrical signal. Our hypothesis is that as the tissues become abnormal and more abnormal, the resistance to the electrical signal becomes less. So by looking at that microcomputer chip, we're able to diagnose if there's normal, abnormal, and what degree of abnormality. That is a hypothesis, and right now we're testing that. But we're testing it in a blinded fashion, meaning that we do the test, we don't do an immediate read of the electrical resistance that's being done at a later date, we gather all the information about the diagnosis, and when we have enough patients on the study, and we're aiming to have 90 in the study, then we'll correlate the reading on the bioprobe to the actual diagnosis.
How will this tie in with the pap smears or the other kinds of tests that go to try to detect any kind of cancer?
Well, this bioprobe, the difference is that the pap smear requires a healthcare provider or somebody trained to obtain the pap smear. The HPV testing usually requires a healthcare provider to do it, although in some countries it's being tested to see if the woman herself could do it, to eliminate that as one of the barriers to being tested.
Because that's an expensive proposition, the HPV test by itself right now, is it not?
It is expensive, but...
I mean,
any test that we do right now, it's expensive. The pap smear, it's also expensive, but we don't see the cost because it's usually underpaid. So meaning that the insurance company don't pay the actual cost, the patients don't pay the actual cost of what it takes to read it. The bioprobe, it's something that if it works, the woman can do that at home.
And that would obviate the importance of going to get your own HPV testing. If the bioprobe is used in that testing, you wouldn't get the pap and the HPV done at the physician's offices then. The bioprobe would be separate.
That is correct. And the bioprobe is something that the woman will have control of. She herself can do it whenever she wants to do it. And, I mean, information will have to be sent to the laboratory for reading. But she'll have more control of that. One of the reasons why women get cervical cancer is because they haven't had a pap smear ever or haven't had a pap smear in 10, 20 years. So this allows for those women that don't have a pap smear because they don't want to go to have it done because they're afraid of the exam. They give them another option.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest, Dr. Enrique Hernandez, professor at Temple University School of Medicine and the chair of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences in the School of Medicine. Dr. Hernandez, what happens after your testing finds that it might be at a medium level or a lower level or a high level? What happens next as far as working towards treatment?
Well, the first step is that we bring the patient into the consultation clinic and do what's called a colposcopy. And the colposcopy is examination of the cervix with magnification. And the microscope that we use to examine the cervix doesn't touch the patient, stays away from the patient, but allows to see the cervix with magnification. And then we try to identify the areas that are abnormal and take a sample of tissue, a biopsy, and then look at that under the microscope. And if we confirm that there is an abnormality that is precancerous, and those we call dysplasia, then we offer the patient treatment, which nowadays in most situations is to surgically remove that piece of the cervix. Not the entire cervix, but just a piece. If it's cancer, then the next step is to stage the cancer, to decide if it's just confined to the cervix or has it spread anywhere else, and then treat the cancer. If the cancer is confined to the cervix, which is stage one, the treatment is very successful, and you're looking at cure rates of around 90%. On the other hand, if the cancer has spread even locally, then the cure rate drops slightly. If it spreads outside of the pelvis, then the cure rate drops significantly.
Is that treatment with radiation or chemotherapy or what?
For stage one, we can treat either with surgery or radiation. For stage two and three and early four, the new thing in the past 5 years or so, it's to treat with a combination of chemotherapy and radiation.
There would be some fear that it might spread to other parts of the body through the lymph nodes and all the rest of it?
That is correct. On the other hand, it's been shown that even when it's local, but more advanced than stage one, that adding chemotherapy improves the results of radiation by about 15 to 30%.
So one of the important things is to first know what's going on and to know the extent to which there is, in fact, some propensity for cancer right there by those tests that you're suggesting will may come into actual usage more extensively, depending upon how accurate they may be. Use a probe.
That is correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there are not too many places that are now studying that in this region, that bioprobe.
Well, the bioprobe for cervical cancer, we are the only place in the world that is studying it.
Is that right?
Yes.
How is that? Is it a local?
Well, the company is a local company. The inventor of the probe and the company is a Pennsylvania company.
They have any idea how long the testing will go on? Is there a time frame?
At the rate that we're going, we're hoping that by the beginning of 2006, we'll have our preliminary information. We'll have completed the first phase of the study, and we'll have information to make public.
Well, you've been involved in so many different things over the years. Even since I last saw you, I see on your resume all kinds of additional activities and recognitions from different groups in which you're a part. What do I see in terms of your being the past president of the prestigious 138-year-old Obstetrical Society of Philadelphia and moving on into all other kinds of things? What takes you into these various acts? Why are you a member of all these different, not just academic groups, but research areas? What's your interest there?
I think that it was my professional upbringing. You know, when I wanted to be a physician, I saw the role models, and it seemed to me that to be a professional, you needed to belong not just to your profession, but to the community at large and do whatever you could for the community. And part of that community is a professional community with different organizations. And when I came to Philadelphia in 1987, one of the first organizations I joined, as I thought it was my duty, was the medical society, the local medical society. And I participated there in a number of ways. Joined the obstetrical society, again, because it's part of being a professional citizen. In the OB society, I eventually was president, as you mentioned, in 1997. The Medical Society of Philadelphia, I was president just last year. I was the 143rd president mm-hmm. of the Philadelphia County Medical Society.
And you've been to a few other things. We must mention that you did your original training in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And then continued here in a number of other degrees and different Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. You have quite a background. I don't want to let people think that a researcher gets so embedded in this research that he forgets some other kinds of activities. And so you are an avid long-distance runner who has run 4 marathons. How do you do that? Do you practice? Do you run every morning?
Well, when I was not the chair of the department, now that I have a little more responsibilities, I used to run at least every day, almost every day. Now the week is usually busy, so I try to go out and run at least one of the weekdays and then weekends. Mm-hmm. And on weekends I will do long runs, maybe 6 miles or 10 if I can, if my body can handle it.
Is running good for a patient who is sick or has cancer? So what role does that kind of activity make in helping a patient?
Well, I will not tell a patient to start running 6 or 10 miles if they've never done it. But physical activity, if people otherwise can do it, I think it's always good. It clears your mind. Your blood is flowing, and it makes you feel better. Keeps your weight down, and that's also a good thing to do in terms of general health.
Positive outlook in terms of how one feels, and regardless of even illness.
Yeah, that is correct.
You also do something very interesting. You play the guitar with the music ministry in one of the churches in the Hispanic Barrio of Philadelphia. And incidentally, you call it in your notes, Hispanic Barrio. Why do you call it that?
Well, I call it that because I think that's what they call it, meaning that there is an area of Philadelphia where the Hispanic community has traditionally gathered and live, and which I find interesting in that when I started meeting them and talking to them and being with them, I started doing that about 10 years ago, is that many of them are related. Either they migrated here and then had all the family members migrate and live in the same area close by, and then they start having children and they stay in the area. Initially and still, most are from Puerto Rico, but now there are many from other countries, Mexico, Central America, South America, Cubans. Actually, there's also in the same area a relatively large Portuguese community.
Mm. Do you find that that connection, even though it may well be because of your own interest, enhances the ability of those people in the area to use services in the health community, knowing that there's somebody who is as feeling and as sympathetic as yourself?
Oh, I hope it does.
Because that's so important. People do not always want to go to healthcare providers and to know that there's somebody there who cares.
And sometimes, and somebody they may feel more comfortable with because they think that they will understand their culture better, and not only the language, but the culture.
Well, I understand that you had a recognition as in humanism in medicine at Temple University. What did that mean for you to receive that?
Well, I was nominated by the medical students. So the medical students that spent time with us, they saw something that they thought that deserved an award and had nominated me to the American Association of Medical Colleges for that award. The way I looked at it, I was just doing what I do every day. I mean, I just doing my job and what I love to do.
Well, it's something, though, to be called a humanist, and it suggests that you have a caring that may transcend even what some people will perceive research to have.
Well, you know, when we take care of patients, I guess my philosophy is that we're looking at a human being and that we're looking at a whole patient, not just a disease or an organ. And I try to teach that don't look at a patient as an illness or an organ that needs to be fixed, to look at the whole individual, and that individual has a family and has needs other than the medical needs.
Dr. Enrique Hernandez, Director of Gynecologic Oncology at Temple University Hospital, recipient of a host of awards and active on many boards and groups. Thank you for being my guest on University Forum.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail at 215-204-4376.